A new study in the journal Nature looks at the economic potential of solar and wind energy on Native American reservations. When those reservations were established, most of them in the mid-19th century, they were intentionally placed to avoid known reserves of coal, oil, and other lucrative natural resources. But now researchers find those same reservations could benefit greatly by harvesting renewable energies like wind and solar power should tribal members choose to do so. We have the study authors from UW-Madison with us. Sarah Johnston is an assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and Dominic Parker is the Bascom Professor of Applied Economics. They talked with my co-host Kate Archer-Kent about their findings.
Nick, I want to start with you. Indigenous lands have a lot of potential for solar and wind power. Can you frame this for us? How big is that potential?
Their estimates of potential in the upper and lower bound, but somewhere between, say, 7 billion and 19 billion if renewable energy potential on reservations tracks what's expected to happen off reservations.
Sarah, you know, when you look at that type of analysis and that type of possibility, how much more wind and solar do reservations have than perhaps non-tribal lands?
Yeah, so we do find that reservation areas are disproportionately endowed with this resources, so they have more than private lands do. And a lot of that is because they were located, intentionally they were located in areas that were bad for farming, but those are often windy and sunny areas that have a lot of potential.
And Nick, there's this historical reason, which is that Indigenous people were pushed off good farmland, forced to move to bad farmland. Can you talk about that history of forced migration and how it relates to reservations having the potential for this renewable energy today?
Particularly in the 19th century, when a lot of Indian reservations were created, there was pressure from settlers. There was pressure from the federal government to place tribes in areas that weren't desirable for settlers from Europe moving westward from the east part of the country. And so what resources were desired then were those with known values, say gold and silver, precious metals, good farmland that was close to water, that had sufficient rainfall. And so the land that was set aside for reservations typically didn't have these resources. And so what you have today is reservations that were almost incidentally or as an accident of history, well endowed with wind and solar. And, you know, now the issue is, can the tribes that want to convert that into a financial gain, can they do that? Or are there some barriers that stand in their way?
And we're going to look at those potential barriers in a moment. But you make this point in the study that this study of economic potential is not meant to advance green colonialism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So historically, tribes have been in a pinch in terms of their resource endowments. On one hand, well-endowed resources on Indian reservations have attracted unwanted attention from the federal government or from settlers over time. And the federal government had set colonial policies to enable access to those resources. And so the point about green colonialism is now we find ourselves in a position where there's a lot of momentum and push towards the energy transition. And so the point in the paper that we were trying to make with that comment is, you know, energy sovereignty for tribes means they shouldn't be pushed into developing green energy because it's a way of addressing climate change. On the other hand, governments shouldn't stand in the way of tribes who do want to develop in this form.
And understanding that there are prospectors out there on green energy projects because they do see the value in that and the potential.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As they have throughout history, have seen potential value of natural resources on indigenous land. We're not just talking about the United States. I mean, globally, there's prospectors who sometimes have really good intentions. They think of this as a win-win. If we could develop indigenous lands, then Indigenous people could gain financially, and this could be a win-win. And so so a lot of times the intentions are good, but this could lead to enormous pressure on tribes to do things that they may not want to do as a community.
Sarah, when you ran the numbers on the economic potential of harvesting renewable energy for tribes, can you give us some of those top line findings, those top line data points?
We do two things in the paper. One, we talk about the overall just potential if you compare endowments and think about the total amount under these energy transition projections. But a big thing we do is quantify the disparity. So we find that reservation areas are much less likely to see utility scale wind and solar development than comparable private lands. And we show that this disparity, if we were to scale it up using these projections, could be up to $19 billion of foregone earnings tribes would accrue had they had development similar to comparable private lands, right? So we're talking about billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars, over $19 billion in lease and tax earnings through 2050. Is that right?
Yes. So one thing that we do make an assumption in the paper is thinking about how what the composition would look like. And we assume that this would be the same as it currently compensation works for private land. So if you have renewable energy development on private land, the community typically accrues some tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also payments to the landowners.
We're talking about a study of the economic potential of solar and wind power on Native American reservations with two of the study authors from UW-Madison. We have Sarah Johnston, an assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. And Nick Parker is with us, applied economics professor. Nick, the key question you're seeking to answer with the study is whether renewable energy could help reduce poverty on reservations. Indigenous people have the highest poverty rates of any minority group in the U.S. Can you talk about the economic realities and what this type of renewable energy could mean?
Absolutely. The poverty for Native Americans in general is extreme, but particularly for those who live on American Indian reservations. They have consistently been the most impoverished minority group in the United States. And reservations are in remote areas. They're far from urban labor markets. Some have benefited from casino development. Some have been very entrepreneurial. But many are at a disadvantage because of their location. So this struck us as important because, you know, here's a resource, wind and solar, that's expected to grow. And the time to kind of remove barriers for tribes wanting to develop is now, if we're going to have continued push towards renewable energy into the future. And so to quantify what this could be, I mean, this is not a panacea, and none of the authors of this study think this is a magic bullet for solving economic development challenges for Indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's potentially an important one. And one of the things we find in the paper is the 25% of American Indian reservations, so there's over 300 in the continental U.S., the 25% that are the poorest are also the 25% with the most wind and solar economic potential. And those are reservations that are remote. They don't have access to opportunities to hold casinos, for example. And so when you think about this potential to earn $19 billion, what does that mean on a per capita basis? Well, if you divide that by the population of American Indians that are living on the poorest 25% of reservations, that number is about 50,000 per person. And that's in, 50,000 per person for a future stream of benefits from wind and solar. Well, to put that in perspective, the per capita income from all other sources for these lower income populations is, 12,000 or so. So this is significant.
It's very significant. And Sarah, if tribal communities would decide that they would like to pursue renewables. We mentioned earlier there are barriers, and I wonder who would tribes need to interface with or build business relationships with off-tribal lands to make renewable energy projects a reality?
So I think that oftentimes tribes who are pursuing utility scale renewable development will partner with wind or solar energy development companies. And you see more too, tribes are also doing their own development, although often partnering with one of these developers who's developed a lot of projects. But beyond that, there's a lot of regulatory hurdles to build this renewable energy infrastructure everywhere, but they're more difficult to navigate. Often on these reservation areas because regulatory authorities has this complicated mixture of there's federal, tribal, and state agencies involved. And there's often just, especially given the federal government, a lot of regulatory steps to go through before building one of these projects.
Nick, do you see any tribal communities moving forward with renewables in the future?
We do. I mean, there's examples of tribes that have started the process, and there's examples of tribes that have completed the process. So there's a big solar energy development on the Navajo Nation. Many tribes are expressing interests. I will say we highlight many of the regulatory barriers in the paper. We talk about the red tape that stands in the way of tribes that do want to develop. It was there for oil and gas and fossil fuel projects. It's still there for renewable energy projects. But the federal government is aware of this. Tribes are aware of this. And it seems there is some movement towards easing some of these obstacles. One thing that we note in the paper is, well, a simple way to streamline the process is to give tribes the authority to make energy development plans without requiring Bureau of Indian Affairs approval for each leasing decision. That is true energy sovereignty, is to make your own decisions without all the regulatory hurdles.
And I noticed at the end of your report a bunch of caveats as well as you talk about all of those different types of, as you mentioned, red tape in order to get to these renewable energy projects. So where does this research go from here?
There is a lot to learn here from detailed case studies. I hope there's a lot of follow-up research digging into specific examples of the experiences of tribes. We're also interested in critical minerals. So there's a push in the U.S. for domestic production of critical minerals that will be necessary for storage batteries in an energy transition, for example. So if the federal government is committed to producing those domestically, not buying them from China, for example, where are you going to look for domestic production of critical minerals? Well, one natural place is American Indian reservations, tribal nations.
Sarah and Dominic, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this research.
Thanks for having us. Pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Sarah Johnston is an assistant professor of agricultural and applied economics, and Dominic Parker is a professor of applied economics, both at UW-Madison. They talked with my co-host Kate Archer-Kent about a study they co-authored in the journal Nature. It's called Economic Potential of Wind and Solar in American Indian Communities.